What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Delighted to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. If you're new to the program, well, we do it exactly for you if you're a non-Catholic. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith and you're looking around trying to get an answer to that question, and lo and behold, here you are on a Catholic network, well, this program is for you. Here is our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can always send us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. Rich Jesse handles social media for us. If you would also like to contact us via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms, so you can give us your question and watch the program at the same time. Just put your question in the comments box, if you would, please, so that Rich can grab it, copy-paste it, and get it to us here in Studio One. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you getting along?
Very well. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Dinner update from last night?
Let me think. Last night, it was amazing. It was fantastic. So I sautéed onions and shiitake mushrooms.
Ooh.
And then I chopped up Brussels sprouts, threw those in, sautéed them, added tempeh. You know what tempeh is?
Yes.
All right, added.
City in Arizona.
Well, there's that, too. I didn't put the whole thing in there.
Oh, yet. Okay.
No, tempeh is a soy product.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
That happens to be the best source after, even before mushrooms, of ergothionine.
Wow.
Which is the kind of the longevity nutrient. But anyway,
okay.
So throw all that in there, seasoned with soy sauce, garlic, and ginger. So it was a yummy, ergothionine-rich feast.
Wow.
And I had ripe plums for dessert.
Oh, man.
Topped it off with a couple of medjool dates.
Did the family go for any of that?
Let's see. I'm trying to remember what everybody else ate. The short answer is no.
No, okay.
No, but it was several steps below in terms of nutrition.
I'm glad you had a good time.
It was great.
Here's a question from Mike in North Carolina. Dr. Anders often refers to the Galileo affair as a misunderstood instance of the church being anti-science, but there are many other ancient cosmological ideas that had to be shed besides geocentrism, such as the shape of the Earth and the difference between stars and other planets. Can Dr. Anders recommend a history of the Church's astronomical knowledge and its contributions in astronomy?
Yes, I can. Wait a minute. The book is The Savior of Science by Father... My mind has just gone blank.
Uh-oh.
Give me 2 seconds. I'll come up with
it. The Savior Science.
No, The Savior of Science.
Oh, The Savior of Science.
Hang on.
And here it comes.
It is. I can't think. Yockey, Stanley Yockey. I couldn't think of it. Yeah, Stanley Yockey. The whole Stanley Yockey's entire career was this question. It was all about the church's contribution to science. Now, a lot of Catholics listening to EWT and also know the name of... Stacy Trasancos.
Oh, yes.
It was a chemist who was an atheist that became a believer, and she did a master's degree in Catholic theology, wrote her master's thesis on the work of Stanley Yockey. So if you want like a one-volume summary of Yockey's contributions, Trasancos's master's thesis has been turned into a book. You can kind of swallow the whole thing in one book if you read Trasancos. If you want the original, go to Stanley Yockey.
All right, Mike in North Carolina, thanks so much for your question. Claire is watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Claire says, what are the best ways to introduce Catholicism to Protestants or Orthodox?
Would it be too self-serving if I said Catholic radio?
I think it's a great start.
You know, honestly, I really do. I think it's a fantastic way. So it really depends on the Protestant or the Orthodox person in question. It really depends on their temperament, because their different modes of engagement are compelling to different kinds of people. So, you know, actually on the way over here, I was listening to a sermon series by Father John Ricardo, who's been on AWTN many times.
Sure.
And he's got this Acts 29 project and this sort of evangelistic program that he runs people through. And I was listening to some of that, and I thought, you know, this would be super attractive for somebody who was kind of used to the ethos of evangelical preaching. He's got that...
The vibe,
and he's tell the stories and get the human interest thing going. He can raise intellectual questions, but make them quite relatable. And, you know, so if somebody was coming from that milieu, somebody like John Ricardo would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, there's another kind of individual who's an intellectual type, and I want to load him down with big, thick, heavy books. you know, then there are other people that are like, ooh, get that theology stuff away from me. So it really depends on the character, the temperament of the person that you're dealing with. But whoever it is, it always has to proceed in an attitude of charity. You know, I think the Catholic has to divest themselves of any attachment to the outcome, right? Because Jesus says, no one can come to me but the Father draw him. Your job is not to convert people. Your job is to present the truth lovingly to them and allow the Holy Spirit to do the rest. And you're unattached. Like you're not trying to compel them or manipulate them in any way. You're trying to open a relationship to them. And for somebody that could be charismatic preaching like Father John Ricardo, for hopefully a lot of people, it's Catholic radio, could be a good book, could be a cup of tea and a kind word and a listening ear. It really depends on the person that you're talking to.
Claire, thanks for watching us on YouTube today. Quick question from Alex. I am a new Catholic, and I want to know, what is the best way to start praying?
Doing it.
Just jump in?
Yeah, doing it. Doing it is the best way to start. Okay. Now, in other words, however you pray, if you are seeking God in your heart and mind, you're engaged in a good project, right? Now, Christ himself answers that question by giving us a formula. He gives us the elements of the Lord's Prayer. So you should absolutely pray the Lord's Prayer. But in praying it, recognize that you're not tied so much slavishly to the words as you are to the concepts, to the ideas, to the direction of the prayer. St. Augustine says every Catholic prayer ought ultimately to be conformed to the model of the Lord's Prayer, which really is reduced to the idea, not my will, but thine be done, thy kingdom come. It's the desire, the hope, the expectation, the purpose to bring God's reign, God's kingdom to your life and those around you.
Alex, welcome to the Catholic Church. We're glad to have you on board here on EWTN's Call to Communion as well. In a moment, we'll talk with Ernest in New Orleans. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN on this beautiful Tuesday afternoon. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Or if you wish, text the letters EWTN to 58177. You know, EWTN is on so many social platforms, hard to keep track, but we are on many, many of them. And one of them is MyTuner. If you're not familiar with MyTuner, all you have to do is open the MyTuner app, search EWTN, and then you'll get it right away. So check that out. Remember, EWTN is everywhere. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Ernest in New Orleans, listening on the great Catholic Community Radio, the Almighty 690. Hey there, Ernest. What's on your mind today, sir?
Wonderful. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Now, listen, I am very pro-life, and I'm very upset with the church, so much that I'm thinking about leaving the church, because some very world-famous Catholics, or so-called Catholics, are screaming that abortion is a woman's right.
I'm deeply sympathetic to your complaint, Ernest. I really appreciate that. So my question for you would be, if a prominent Catholic says something, do we understand that prominent Catholic as speaking for and representing the teaching of the Church? Just because some prominent Catholic has said something, does that mean that the Church as a whole takes that position?
No, he's not speaking for the Church, but I'm wondering why they are not excommunicated. No Catholic can believe in the Church.
Sure. That I can appreciate. So let's unpack that a little bit. First of all, as far as the Church's teaching is concerned, I think you'd probably concede that the Church is pretty clear on the ethics of abortion. I mean, from the first century, maybe into the first, beginning of the second, the Didache, an early ancient Christian document, explicitly condemns abortion. And then you'll find it repeated in theology and in canon law, basically from the first century all the way to the present. And in recent times, of course, John Paul II reiterated the 2,000-year history of the Church's opposition to abortion in his encyclical on the Gospel of Life. And so this is really undergirded Catholic moral theology forever, and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is pretty clear in its opposition to abortion, and the Holy See is clear in its opposition to abortion, and historically in the United States, the one consistent party that opposed abortion under all circumstances has always been the Catholic Church, and other Christian denominations that claim to support life. They're a bit weak-kneed about it because they always tend to allow for certain kinds of exceptions. I live in the state of Alabama, and a lot of Alabamians claim to be pro-life. We recently had a little legal kerfluffle over the status of embryos, and it was interesting to see all the evangelical Protestants backtrack that commitment to the sanctity of life just as fast as they could when it came up against a political inconvenience. But you didn't see Catholics walking back their teaching.
Nope.
On things like IVF or abortion. Catholics have always said that the embryo has dignity and should be treated as a human being, no matter what the circumstances, regardless of what everybody else in the room might be thinking. So the Catholic Church really is the only show in town when it comes to consistently, comprehensively presenting the gospel of life. And if somebody leaves the Catholic Church and attempts to make an intellectual case for the pro-life position, depriving themselves of the Catholic patrimony is really not going to help that at all. I mean, you're not going to strengthen your hand as a pro-life activist if you leave the Church. Now, I don't know how that could possibly help you, because you can only affiliate with groups that one way or another have a weaker commitment to life than the Church does. So your complaint really is not about the Church's teaching. It's about the enforcement of its own internal discipline, all right? And that is a question, of course, not about infallible truth, but about the prudential judgment of a particular bishop. And one thing the Church has never said is, look to the prudential judgment of any particular bishop that you choose, and you will find an exemplar of Christian holiness. That's never been the position. Bishops, as individuals, have always done just god-awful stupid things. And we'll continue to do so until the end of time. Now, we have had wise and saintly bishops. We have had some humdingers of bad bishops, too, throughout the centuries. And that's part and parcel of the business. Now, when it comes to this particular issue, what you don't know is what has that bishop said to the individual in question behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And what kind of moral reasoning is the bishop bringing to bear? I mean, I'm not going to take a stand right now on what some bishop should do in his own diocese, but I'll throw out a consideration for you. The Church's position on abortion has nothing to do intrinsically with politics. I mean, if we all lived on an anarcho-syndicalist commune in the middle of some desert island in the Pacific, right, and there were no formal government— abortion would be wrong regardless of the absence or presence of any kind of political arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
But in the modern world, particularly in the West, abortion is an intensely political question, allied to parties and to ideological groups, and it's almost impossible to engage the question without getting the political thing going.
It's a hot potato.
It's a hot potato, right? And that puts the Catholic moralist at a particular kind of risk. And the risk is that my actions be perceived through an exclusively political lens. And so if I engage this particular topic, what I risk is that many people in my diocese will conflate my position with the adoption of a political platform or an ideological program, right, without understanding there's an underlying moral issue that has nothing to do with those things. And I, as a bishop, might judge that the way to handle this is through a kind of individual pastoral approach rather than risking the gross misunderstanding of my intervention, mm-hmm. which will almost surely not result in this individual changing their mind. And so, now, I'm not telling you that's the right kind of moral calculus. I'm telling you it's an intelligible one. It's one that a bishop could take, perhaps in good conscience. It might be the wrong decision, but it doesn't necessarily mean the bishop in question is a terrible person. On the other hand, maybe the bishop in question is a terrible person, right? I mean, like, either one of those is perfectly conceivable in the Catholic. And my position as a lay Catholic is not to condition my own adherence to the Catholic faith on what some bishop does.
Yeah.
Right? And if you do think you have to do that, well, then why not? Why pick the bad bishop as your exemplar?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Why not go pick out a good bishop and go, well, he's doing the right thing. I'll stay Catholic for his sake.
Yeah. I often think there is no shortage of people or things to pray about.
No shortage.
At all. Ernest, thanks so much for your call from New Orleans. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to communion here on this Tuesday afternoon with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. Let's go to John now in South Dakota, listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Hey, John, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller. I'm kind of nervous. But listening a short time ago, Dr. Anders was, recommending, to just go ahead and pray, and just say whatever you want kind of thing. Well, from a perspective of someone that fell away from church for most of my life, I mean, I lived a life of terrible sin, lost wives and marriages and kids and everything terrible. And one of the things that I always hung on to over the years, well, I'm still praying. I'm still talking to Jesus. He's still in my back pocket. Maybe he'll help me sort all of this sinful activity out, And I really believed it, because you think, this is me, so this is going to be okay. It's real easy to fall into that hole. And I'm just making note of that. I guess that's all I have.
Okay.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. And so in a previous call, I said the important way to get started praying is to start praying.
Mm-hmm.
But then I qualified it, you'll note, right after that, I qualified it by saying Jesus gave us the model of prayer, the essence of which is thy kingdom come, thy will be done. So it's not Jesus, my will be done. It's Jesus, thy will be done. And in practice, a lot of people, myself included, fall into, could we let my will be done in this instance? Let me tell you how it ought to work out, Jesus. Let me lay it out there for you. You do what I say and everything will be all right. That's what we often do as humans. And then we justify it thinking that, well, hey, I spent 8 hours in prayer giving Jesus my laundry list, right? I must be a great guy. That's why St. John of the Cross once said, very simply, he said, many people pray quite badly and think that they pray well. Others pray quite well and think they pray badly.
Mm.
It's one of the reasons that spiritual direction is advised for Catholic spiritual growth, because we're never good judges of our own spirituality.
John, thanks for checking in from South Dakota. Call to communion here on EWTN. Shike is watching us on YouTube today. Shike says, well, yesterday you ended the program but was stopped by the music when you wanted to explain why the Protestants removed all the images and crucifixes from their churches. Could you please finish that today?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So historically, not all Protestants have taken crucifixes out of their churches. In the 16th century, Luther didn't take crucifixes out of his churches, and Lutheran churches in Germany continue to have a lot of religious artwork of that sort and so forth. And there are Episcopalian churches that do the same. So it wasn't, it wasn't necessary to Protestantism that you do that. But in Zurich, there was a reformer by the name of Ulrich Zwingli, who, for philosophical reasons, had a problem with using any kind of material props in worship. He was kind of a Renaissance Platonist, and he had an intellectualist conception of Christian faith and the Christian life, and so he was sort of allergic to using material props. And he sought to bolster that intuition through his interpretation of the Ten Commandments. And he saw the Ten Commandments first and second commandments, second commandment being have no graven images. And he interpreted that to mean, you can't have any kind of religious artwork whatsoever at all. And so the objection to the corpus on the cross, from a Zwinglian point of view, was that you were depicting a physical representation of Christ. So they were iconoclasts. The Zwinglians were iconoclasts, said you couldn't have any kind of physical representation of Jesus. Now, what happened is that real hardcore iconoclasm remained in the Reformed tradition. That's the tradition that Zwingli started for a while. And you still find a handful of Reformed congregations today that have whitewashed churches and no religious ark. But it didn't last very long. And most Protestant churches, evangelical churches, they have so much religious art going on, they can't even like climb out from underneath it. I mean, I know when I grew up in the Presbyterian Church, that's a Reformed denomination, and you know, I can't tell you the number of flannel graphs we looked at that had you know, bearded Jesus in his Bedouin clothing, surrounded by sheep, you know, all that little kid kind of artwork, and there's that famous devotional picture of Christ, and he's all sort of beaming and happy and smiley, and looks like some, you know, hippie out of Haight-Ashbury, who you know the one I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
that
kind of stuff is just ubiquitous. And so the objection, well, we can't have any physical depiction of Jesus, was just falling on deaf ears. But Protestants knew that they didn't have the corpus on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
They forgot why, that it was this iconoclasm, but they knew that they didn't. And so someone rationalized the absence of the crucifix in Protestant churches by claiming that it had to do with Catholic denial of the resurrection, which is just insane. I mean, it's insane because it evidences such a poor knowledge of Catholic theology and devotion and history, but a poor knowledge of Protestant history, too, for that matter.
Sure. Appreciate that. And Shikay, thanks for watching us on YouTube this afternoon. This quick question as we're going to break here, this is from Kay. Dr. Anders, I pray the rosary every day, but I do it on an app in the background while I'm doing chores, etc. So my question is, am I required to be holding a rosary as I do it? Thank you, Kay.
You're not required to pray the rosary, period, at all, ever, not once. The rosary is not part of the Catholic liturgy, and there's no law of the church imposing an obligation to pray the rosary. Right, so it's a devotional prayer, pretty much uniquely of the Latin Catholic tradition. So the Catholic East doesn't know about the rosary, and the medieval, for that matter. So for the first 1,000 years of the church, people didn't pray the rosary, and it was a development over time. And it's extremely helpful to a lot of folks, and it's probably the most popular devotion in the Catholic Church outside of the Mass. And so it's commended by popes and bishops and the faithful who found it tremendously useful. But the idea that there's some kind of strict rubric that governs the quote-unquote proper use of the rosary, and should you fall away from that rubric, the whole thing falls apart and ceases to be effective, one, isn't true to the doctrine of the rosary. But secondly, I think it evidences a gross misunderstanding of the way that devotional prayer works. All Catholic spiritual orators say if you're praying the rosary or the Stations of the Cross or whatever else it is, and you find yourself sort of taken up in the wordless love of God, maybe after the first bead, well, the thing to do at that point is to put the rosary aside and go with the love, because the point of every devotion is to inflame your emotions with a passionate love for God that sort of sweeps you away and enables you to more easily live the life of virtue. As long as it has that effect, you're doing it the right way, whether you play it on an app or, you know, whether you pray, you know, this mystery or that mystery. I have a Lebanese friend who loves the rosary and loves the Blessed Virgin Mary, and he's invented his whole new series of mysteries for himself.
You know,
it's like beyond the standard ones that Catholics pray.
Okay.
Most of which have to do with events from the life of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And he was out praying with this parish one time, and he starts like improvising on the, like, we're going to pray the seventh mystery of Mary. And they're like, come on, man.
That's great. Kay, thanks so much for your email. Appreciate that. In a moment, we'll talk with Rita Marie in Highland, California. Rich is in Queens. Terry is in North Dakota. Two lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. You know, one of the slogans that we use around here, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Well, here's your opportunity to tell us, 833-288-3986. Meanwhile, here is Rita Marie in Highland, California, listening to us on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Rita Marie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Sure.
My question is this. I'm very nervous, but I am a cradle Catholic, so I have no clue what goes on other than a short time participated in an evangelical church, which brought me back to Catholic Church. But my granddaughter and her husband, he is a youth pastor for many years, okay? Well, a few years ago, he started getting very interested in loving our Blessed Mother, kind of like a Scott Hahn story.
Okay.
Long story short, in a few weeks, he is going to be called in before the elders. I think that's how he referred to them, and the head pastor there. And they're going to question him on 9 points. I don't know anything about the 9 points. And if you know what they are, you want to share them with me if you know what they are. But my main question is, how can I support them? This is their livelihood. Well, his, you know, that's his job. And I want to be there every step of the way to help them.
So he works for this other church?
Yes, he is a youth pastor right now.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So I obviously have absolutely no clue what these 9 points are they're going to interrogate him on, but I have some guesses, and these are just guesses. If it stems from his interest in the Blessed Virgin Mary and his devotion to her, then that's going to make any Protestant congregation nervous. That's going to make them nervous. So they're going to want to know, probably off the bat, is he in fact praying to Mary? I mean, does he just think Mary is a pretty cool character from Scripture whose life is to be emulated? Or is he actually seeking her prayers and intercessions? Does he believe that Mary intercedes for us? And that would be kind of ground zero for any Protestant denomination. And if he up and fesses up that, well, you know, I've been praying to the Blessed Virgin Mary, then that's a deal breaker, right? Honestly, they're either going to say, you're out of here, or recant, or you're out of here. I mean, it's going to be one of the two, and probably you're out of here, or you're at least on suspension or something until you get your theology straight. I mean, they're not going to let him proceed if he is praying to Catholic saints. That's just not going to happen. They may attack him on other Marian dogmas. Do you believe this about Mary? Do you believe in her perpetual virginity? Do you believe in the Immaculate Conception? Do you believe in the Assumption? If they think that that Mary devotion is a gateway to Catholicism, well, first of all, they'd be correct about that, and they might want to interrogate him on other Catholic doctrines. They might want to interrogate him on whether or not he believes in sacred tradition as opposed to the Bible alone. They might want to interrogate him on the doctrine of justification by faith, which is kind of the signature Protestant doctrine, or does he believe that we're justified by faith working through love, as the Catholic Church teaches. They may want to interrogate him on the authority of popes and bishops. They might want to interrogate him on the nature of the sacraments, on baptism, on the Eucharist, and the rest of it. These are the kinds of things that I think. There was a time when I worked in a Protestant church. I worked in a Protestant institution, and part of my job was to hire faculty for a school. And I would vet them on their commitment to Protestant doctrine. And if I sniffed out anything that even hinted of Catholicism, it would have gone ding, 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 warning bell, warning bell, warning bell,
yeah.
You know. And so that's probably where they're going to go. Now, in terms of how you should support them, well, I mean, you ought to just keep on loving them and wishing them well and expressing your goodwill and openness to them and let them, you know, kind of, they're going to have to make their own decisions about their religious life. Now, I will say a couple things. First of all, if the young man really has moved to a position of openness to the Catholic faith and of devotion to Mary, then he's going to have to make a decision.
Yeah.
He's going to have to say, do I stay in this line of work as a Protestant youth pastor? In my judgment, and look, I can't tell him this, but in my judgment, once the Protestant pastor has started praying to Mary, it's all over. It's just a matter of time. He's not going to be in that job 2 years from now.
No.
Well, even if he makes it through this interrogation, Mary's going to get the better of him, and he's going to be out of there in 2 years, right?
Yeah.
And so he's got to come to terms, you know, Martin Luther, Protestant leader, was called upon at the Council of Worms, the Diet of Worms, to recant his Protestantism and return to the Catholic faith. And Luther said, my conscience is held captive to the word of God. Here I stand, I can do no other. And Protestants have often hailed Luther's devotion to his conscience and the word of God, and that's, he's kind of a great Protestant hero. Well, I don't agree with Luther's conclusions, but I agree with the premise, namely that you cannot be disobedient to conscience. That's actually a Catholic doctrine. So I tell people, you know, who are facing these kinds of decisions, if you've gotten to the point that your conscience has convicted you that the Catholic faith is true, well, you're eventually going to have to be Catholic. I mean, it doesn't have to be tomorrow, but you just can't live at odds with your conscience for too long. And yeah, you know, like no youth pastor job is worth disobedience to your conscience. And for that matter, most youth pastor jobs aren't worth a whole lot financially anyway. Mm. You know, like it's not like he can't get a living in doing something else, right? And for that matter, if he were to become Catholic, we have so much need for youth ministry in the Catholic Church. It isn't even funny. And not only at the parish level, but there are national apostolates that need help. I mean, there's a ton of work for people who are skilled in working with youth within the Catholic Church. So there's a lot of avenues open to him. The other thing I would suggest is that it'd be helpful to him to rub shoulders with people who have been in a similar position. Marcus Gerdau's organization, the Coming Home Network, exists for that reason. It exists to be a point of contact for Protestants, especially clergy, who are discerning the Catholic faith, and particularly when it threatens their livelihood. And you know, we got a lot of people running around here at EWTN that are former Protestant ministers of one kind or another, you know, have been in his boat exactly. And so reaching out to those folks is very helpful. And he probably needs someone that he can dialogue with from, who's been where he is, both theologically and interpersonally. And I would invite him to reach out to me. Right, I'd be happy to talk to him, and he can either call the show, or if he wants to shoot a email to the network, to ctc@ew10.com, he can get a hold of our producer over here, Charles Beery, who can put us in touch, and maybe I can help him out with his questions, either theological or professional, because we've all been there.
Marie, thank you again for your concern there for your family member, and thanks so much for your call. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Terry now in North Dakota, listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Terry, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, or good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. When pondering on the agony in the garden, Peter cuts off the soldier's ear with his sword, and that's listed in all four Gospels. Do you suppose he wore a sword all the time, being he just came from the Last Supper?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I have absolutely no idea. You know, in different cultures at different times, it's been more or less common to carry arms of one kind or another. I mean, this is something actually totally different context, but St. Ignatius of Loyola carried arms. He was a former soldier, and he was a very proud man, and so he ticked off a lot of people and when he was a sort of young hothead, and he actually had to carry arms for self-defense because there were a lot of people that wanted to take it out on him. So he got special permission to walk around with a sword in case anybody jumped him out of a dark alley, you know. He eventually put that away in the service of Christ. Renaissance Italy is another context where Catholics of a certain social class almost always carried weapons with them, and they were sort of expected to. And there have been periods of time when Catholic people, even eminent Catholic people, have felt that it was appropriate or necessary to go armed. Swords are not cheap, and you have to have the raw materials. You have to be worked. You know, most peasants in Galilee didn't have a whole lot of excess cash. So I don't know a lot of what I'm talking about here, but it seems to me difficult that everybody running around Galilee was armed to the teeth, you know. It's hard for me to know. I'd have absolutely no idea.
Terry, thanks so much for your call. It certainly is fascinating. Here is Rich now. Rich is in Queens, New York, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey there, Rich. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, good afternoon, Dr. Anders. My question is regarding habitual sin from addiction, involving addiction, I should say. What is the church's teaching regarding the severity of sin in those cases?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So obviously, psychology can mitigate and relativize the culpability for habitual sin when it proceeds from some kind of really deeply ingrained psychological condition. But here's the caution I would give you, right? So if you're a pastor, if you're a therapist, if you're engaged in the process of pastoral counseling, this is a very helpful thing to know, because your patient, your client, your parishioner, whoever it is, if you have this understanding that this person's really, you know, stuck in a bad rut and they've got reasons for that, it helps you to be compassionate, not be judgmental, and really accompany them without losing patience. However, if you're the person himself, it can also become a crutch that says, well, you know, I have this thing and it's proceeds from OCD and it's habitual and I can't really get over it, and therefore I can give myself a pass. And I think that's unhelpful, and here's why. And better just to leave the question of culpability up to God, not even worry about that too much. And here's why I think so. So the church's doctrine of sin is not that virtue and vice are only connected to the life of heaven. You know, God has set up some arbitrary list of things that you have to do, and if you do them, you get into heaven. If you fail, you don't get into heaven, and that's all it is. Rather, the life of grace, life of virtue, is really quite continuous between this life and the next. And you know, God commands us to be happy, believe it or not, that virtue is the quest for human happiness here and now, that we try to live the kind of life that tends to human flourishing, that best accords with our nature. And so if it's the case that I lose my freedom of action because of an addiction or compulsion or obsessive compulsive disorder or something like that, then whether or not I think of myself culpable in some sort of highly abstract way, the truth of the matter is I'm not flourishing. Right, I'm not living my best life. Yeah. I'm not happy, right? And to just justify that and say, well, you know, God's not holding me accountable for this at the moment. Well, I mean, I'm still suffering, right? Yeah. I'm still suffering. And playing head games with myself like that is one of the maladaptive behaviors I'm trying to get rid of, right? I mean, like getting all up in my own brain and coming up with all kinds of warrants and justifications and arguments, I might need to step out of that whole process in order to get my head straight. And so, you know, the tools of cognitive therapy, for example, mm-hmm. are all about, like, I know I do this. I create these kind of moral, intellectual, emotional conundrum for myself. And then I sort of go to war in my own head trying to win these battles. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie War Games, a John Badham film in the 1980s starring Matthew Broderick.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a scene in the film where there's a computer simulation of a thermonuclear war, right? And it risks turning into a real thermonuclear war. And they need the computer to figure out that there's no way to win a thermonuclear war. And so the computer just, like, runs all these endless simulations of these battles. And finally it learns and says, strange game. The only way to win is not to play. And I think that's probably a bad model for political policy, but it's a really good model for certain kinds of psychological dilemma, right?
Yeah.
You get yourself kind of wrapped up in your own brain, and you try to think yourself out of a box. And then one day you realize, you know, this is a bad, stupid game I'm playing. The only way to win is not to play. I need to step out of this whole way of framing my situation and come with a completely different way of framing my situation. And so, you know, the tools of therapy are very helpful. Tools of Catholic spirituality are very helpful. But at the end of the day, like, a really profound desire to be free.
Yes.
You know, like, I want to be free of this. And I know that it's not, I'm never going to win by willpower alone. That's something that all the addiction literature shows. Willpower is a fading resource, right? You use it up really quick and then you're just toast. I have to find a new way to live. I'm not going to win the battle from within the frame of reference that I'm currently occupying. And for me, for somebody, that might be, you know, endless rumination about the question of guilt. Like, yeah. Am I guilty? Am I not guilty? Am I guilty?
Sure.
Am I not guilty? Right.
Sure.
Like, that's the frame of reference I've got now. Guess what? It's not working for me. I need a new frame of reference. Right. And I don't know what that is for you or whoever we're talking about. Right. But as Kierkegaard said, get possibility, right? Get out of your own head. Get it some totally new way of framing your reality, and cut off all contact with people, places, and things that trigger those kind of thoughts and those kind of behaviors.
Great call. Thank you, Rich. Appreciate hearing from you in Queens. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Let me give you a vital public service message at this time. What is today? Tuesday. What is Sunday? Mother's Day. Don't forget. Get that card, get that gift, a dinner, even if it's just a phone call. Don't forget about Mom. And we never forget about mothers around here. You know, it wouldn't be Mother's Day without Mother Angelica. And this Sunday, we're going to celebrate Mother's Day all day, EWTN style, with specials including Mother's wonderful series on heaven. We're going to broadcast that on Sunday, honoring our foundress, of course, Mother Angelica. And I know that you're a big fan not only of mothers, but also Mother's Day and Mother Angelica.
All of the above, man, all of the above.
Absolutely.
So I have got three mothers in my immediate family that I deal with on a regular basis. A grandma, a wife, a daughter, you know, who's a mother.
Sure.
And so I said, my contribution to Mother's Day is going to be, I'm going to babysit and let all the mothers go out.
Good man.
Yeah.
Good man. So don't forget not only to take care of that mom in your heart, but also to keep it on EWTN Radio as we celebrate Mother's Day all day long on Sunday. All right, back to the phones right now. Let's go to Cincinnati and talk with Ann, a first-time caller listening on the great Sacred Heart Radio, AM 740. Ann, what's on your mind today?
Hi, this is thank you for taking my call. I'm calling regarding my daughter. She's one of my eight children. She's now 26 and newly married, but she was raised Catholic, homeschooled, went to Catholic college, but has since in her adult life left the church for, I guess, an ecumenical church. And my question is, when she mentioned to me the other evening that she's going to be getting baptized, and I didn't have an answer because I said, well, you've already been baptized. And so she said, no, this is like a recommitment, you know, of my, you know, living for Jesus or whatever. So I was hoping to gain some information on, like, what the church teaches and how I could respond to this, like, rebaptism. I just don't understand it.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you can't get rebaptized any more than you can get, like, reborn physically.
You can get wet.
You can get wet, exactly. You know, baptism is death and rising with Christ. That's what Paul says. We die with Christ in baptism. We're raised again with him to new life. That's Romans chapter 6. In the book of Galatians, Paul says, whoever has been baptized has clothed himself with Christ. Well, you know, you're clothed with Christ. You have that identity of Christ imprinted upon you. You can't lose that ever. You don't stop having Christ being part of the member of his body, the church. You don't ever cease doing that. And so you know, to suggest that I can do it again is to somehow suggest that the promises of baptism were null and void the first time around, which, of course, is not true. But a lot of this hinges on the person understanding and accepting the Catholic teaching on the way on what baptism is and why it's effective, right? And so if an individual were to come to the false belief that baptism is merely a sign of my interior commitment, well, my commitment is a various thing. I mean, it can wax and wane. I can have more or less of it. I can fall away from my commitment. I can go back to my commitment. And if baptism merely signals my act of commitment, well, then as many times as I need to recommit myself, I might rebaptize myself because that's all it is. And so that's a really anemic doctrine of baptism, right? Whereas the Catholic doctrine of baptism really does provide that view of baptism provides absolutely no stability or hope in the Christian life, right? Because if my attachment to Christ is only a matter of my psychological commitment, well, then it's no stronger than my own psychology.
Yeah.
Whereas the Catholic position is that I'm in God's hands, that I've become his child through baptism, that I'm a member of his church through baptism, that Christ has joined me to himself in an indelible way, and I stand in a kind of in a permanent eternal relationship to that I have a right and a claim on the grace of God and the sacraments of the church no matter what I do. Doesn't mean I can sin with impunity and go to heaven, but I can sin with impunity and come back, right? Because I've got that indelible mark on my soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Catholic doctrine of baptism really does provide a basis for transcendent hope in the way the wishy-washy version doesn't, because it's no stronger than my own commitment. Okay, now, problem is, that's the truth. How do you deliver that to a 26-year-old daughter who's married? That's a whole nother can of worms.
Yeah.
And I would be shocked if this decision didn't have something to do with the marriage, that the husband's got something to do with this. And people's religious commitments are so tied up in their family commitments and their relationships, you know, in their social circles and so forth, that we make ourselves very selective in the kind of truths that we let penetrate our consciousness. And when the truth is coming from mom who homeschooled me, who I've been listening to for 26 years and about whom I know absolutely everything, and there's no new thing she can tell me, right? And that's the way most 26-year-olds feel about their mothers.
Yep.
All right. Can you get that message through to her in a way that will have an effect other than making her angry or self-justifying or alienating her? I can't answer that question. But I will tell you this, that all 10 years I've been doing this show, the number of people who've called me with adult children who have left the faith, for whom the answer, well, just go tell them that they're wrong and they'll turn around, has been the correct response, is vanishingly low.
Yes.
I mean, nigh unto zero.
Yeah.
So my recommendation is you not hit it head on like that, even though you're armed with the truth, because the likelihood that she listens to you is really, really low, right?
Yep.
And so you've been giving her the truth of Catholic doctrine for 26 years. It didn't take. So we need to find another approach, right? Doing more of the same probably isn't going to produce a different result. We need another approach. And you might shock her by being coming across as incredibly open-hearted, open-minded, and accepting without actually affirming her religious beliefs. You know, like, hey, you're an adult. You're going to do the things that you're going to do. I love you no matter what. I'm a Catholic. I'm staying Catholic. But my door is always open, and you're always in my prayers. And have a great life. And we'll still be here. You know, the Catholic Church will still be here in 70 years if you want to come back.
Wow, beautiful. And thanks so much for your call from Cincinnati. Katie is watching us on YouTube today. Katie says, I am a Catholic, although I wonder why we feel uncomfortable when talking faith with our separated brethren or listening to preaching to either side or attending their services, yet we both claim to be Christians.
Right. So I'm sorry you feel uncomfortable. I don't feel uncomfortable. I feel quite comfortable talking to my separated brethren. But I can understand the sentiment. And there could be a couple of reasons. So one is Catholics can be very threatened by non-Catholic Christians. If the Catholic feels that they don't have a good grip on their own faith and they encounter a really enthusiastic non-Catholic who seems to know the Bible very well and can kind of run circles around them in terms of biblical quotations and is very attuned to sort of theological argument, and the Catholic may feel out of their depth and unable to defend the faith, and that could make a person feel uncomfortable. Another thing that could be threatening to a Catholic is if you listen to, say, an evangelical preacher who's just a very compelling preacher, really engaging, and seems to be weaving this narrative, this story about his life or the life of his congregation that seems so wrapped up in God and the love of Christ, and there seems to be so much power and joy there, and you think, well, gee, my life doesn't feel quite that much. That could seem threatening. Now, I'm going to say something about both of those conditions, okay? The number of evangelical preachers who can tell a compelling story like that and have you wrapped around their finger and absolutely convinced that they're God's best friend, who then turns around and you find out, you know, the scandal sheets come out and their lives are a wreck and their wives are alienated and their children are off doing, you know, heaven knows what. And you find out that, you know, they're drawing a, you know, multiple times six-figure salary from the megachurch that they founded, and they turn out to be narcissistic leaders who demand that everybody kowtow to their perspective. That character is ubiquitous in the evangelical world, because what draws people to the top of that ministry typically is talent, not holiness. And they're really, really compelling speakers. And they understand the story they have to tell about themselves in their church in order to sell. And it's attractive, it's compelling, it's engaging, right? That's not the same thing as holiness. And the same thing goes for the Protestant who knows the Bible well and can weave an argument. And I say this as someone who was a Protestant who knows the Bible well and who can weave an argument, right? That I'm conscious in my own life of my ability to do those things has absolutely nothing to do with the question of my own personal morals, ethics, or holiness. Just ask my children.
Mm.
Right? I mean, one of my sons said to me one time, he said, Daddy, you're always right about everything and nobody cares. You know, like we see right through you, Dad, you know?
Mm.
And so don't be intimidated by rhetoric, by showmanship. It's flashy, it's attractive, but it's a far cry from the holiness that Christ demands of us. So that, you know, that's what I have to say. So, you know, do learn your faith, learn how to defend it, learn the arguments for it. But at the end of the day, St. John says, if we claim that we know Jesus and don't walk as he walked, if we don't love the brethren deeply from the heart, then the truth is not in us.
Katie, thank you so much for checking us out on YouTube today. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
We do this program right here on EWTN Radio 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern. And you can check out the podcast anytime you wish by going to EWTN.com, click on radio, and then once you're there on that radio homepage, just look for the words Podcast Central. Scroll down a little bit and you will find Call to Communion. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you next time right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have yourself a wonderful day and God bless.